morning, all. The first case for argument is Goodman versus Department of Professional Regulation. Mr. Draper.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, we're here today to address again something of a series of state regulatory actions that, in the name of consumer protection, place extremely high hurdles or outright bans on effective marketing communications by people like Dr. Goodman, who wish to reach their market of potential patients. This is an important issue that we're here on in dealing with the denial of the preliminary injunction by the district court in this case. We believe that denial was an abuse of discretion, and this court should reverse it with instructions to enter the preliminary injunction. The problem that we face today arises from the fact that every year thousands of people are injured in automobile accidents and promptly need some kind of medical care. Dr. Jason Goodman is a chiropractor who's licensed by the state of Illinois to provide care to those very kinds of people, and he wishes to reach them in a manner and time that is timely and effective for their medical needs. As he testified in the case, timing is very important in this area, and it's important that he reach his target audience at an appropriate time to offer services that they may benefit from.
Even if you're right that this regulation is unconstitutional, can't the district judge's decision to deny preliminary injunction be justified on the basis of just alone that you didn't provide a transcript of what these telemarketers were going to say, the script, anything about their training, and how they were selected, and all that sort of stuff?
We think not. We think that the evidence was very clear, and in fact, the district judge took some pains to note that we had, in fact, presented some clear testimony about the kind of speech that would be included and the kind of script. Now, the actual script had not been written at this time that would be appropriate for because he hadn't opened his office and begun the preparation to make sure it conformed with all aspects of Illinois law. Judge Scott raised some questions about some other peculiar aspects of Illinois law, for example, in her questioning.
Is that permitted in any other state?
He's doing it right now in the state of Missouri, for example.
Well, and did he have a script that he uses in Missouri?
He does have a script. But
why wasn't that presented to the district court?
It wasn't presented because that script is not the one that would be used, so we'd be falling back to the same, this is an example or this is a description. And we don't think that
why would the script be different in Missouri than it would be in Illinois?
It would be different just because of some differences in how you approach people. I'm not sure what the script...
Why are people in Illinois not approachable the same way people in Missouri are approachable?
Well, they may be, Your Honor, but the First Amendment does not, and there's no body of jurisprudence saying that the First Amendment rights can only be protected if you get advance approval. And in essence, that's what Judge Scott was asking for, was the exact script to be presented. And that would narrow the case down to exactly those words. Dr. Goodman wouldn't be free to deviate from them, to continue to take advantage of experience. And it's a reason why we did not present the precise script. We think that the judge made a clear error in the analysis. It's not his burden to prove exactly every single word that he would use.
But
show it's not misleading or it's lawful activity.
Right, but how can the court make that determination without having... I appreciate you may not have wanted him to have to read it word for word, but certainly more than just an estimate of what it might be or guesstimate, having the... you wouldn't necessarily be bound to just those words.
Well,
I just don't get it. I don't see how the court can make the determination without having that script. Just generally describing what it would do is not enough.
He actually spent quite some time, both in his affidavit and testimony, describing how the caller would introduce themselves, that within the first 60 seconds they would make sure that they identified which practice they were from, that they were calling from Dr. Goodman's office, the nature of the call, that it was an invitation for them to have a free 10-point exam and evaluation at no obligation, that they would make an appointment, and detailed response to what if the caller asked a question about medical care or what does chiropractic do, and explaining that the script would tell them you'll need to speak with the doctor about that, and he will be calling you in a few minutes to confirm your appointment, and clearly identifying that they're not going to go beyond those parameters. You know, we could write it out, frankly, from what he testified to. The purpose of the call is simply to make the offer, to make sure the consumer knows that this is a no obligation. They're not obligated to use the doctor for treatment. They're not obligated to pay anything. They're not obligated in any other way. And then he also went through some of the other safeguards, all of the ones about when to stop the call if the consumer seems to indicate a reluctance, if the consumer indicates they're already under the care of a physician or another chiropractor. He went through some detail of all of the measures to show that the kind of communication he's going to engage in is not misleading. And there's no question that it's, of course, lawful activity.
Did anyone suggest that the district judge combine a preliminary injunction with a permanent injunction hearing?
We did not. And then, of course, during the judge's ruling, she wanted to have more of the evidence fleshed out, as she said, and suggested that discovery would be an important element. The state took advantage of, there were 6 weeks between filing the complaint and the hearing. The state didn't engage in any discovery, and I assume was not prepared to consent to that as well. So no thought was given to that, and instead we're preparing the discovery now. What the state conceded in their brief is the standard that this court needs to apply for reversal, and the abuse of discretion standard is met. As the state noted, if we demonstrate that the court engaged in an error of law or a clear error on the facts, we think both happened in this case. And the biggest problem comes with the court's analysis and the failure to follow the teachings of the Central Hudson test. There's no question that this kind of speech meets the first threshold of Central Hudson. The case relied on most by the state is the Illinois Supreme Court case in Desnick. Even in Desnick, the Illinois Supreme Court, dealing with an ophthalmologist with a history of potential malpractice claims and other disciplinary problems, brought his claim as a defense. Even in that case, the Illinois Supreme Court had no trouble ruling that the kind of solicitation, personal solicitation, by the ophthalmologist met that threshold barrier.
Well, doesn't the district court have to make an initial finding that the speech is likely to be protected commercial speech before making that Central Hudson analysis?
Well, that's part of the Central Hudson test. The first threshold before you get to the balancing that Central Hudson talks about is answered by this. Is the speech about lawful activity? In this case, there's no question but that it is. And is the speech not misleading? And there is no evidence that there would be anything misleading about the information Dr. Goodman wanted to present. And instead, he went to some great lengths to describe how it would not be. Recall that the state put on no evidence, and in fact, in cross-examining Dr. Goodman, didn't even challenge his assertion that his speech would be low-key and not pressuring and not misleading. So what the district judge did that we think is clear error is failed to find that we crossed that threshold. We clearly crossed the threshold, and all of the authority, even in the state's briefs, support that. So factually, there really is no dispute what Dr. Goodman intends to communicate to potential patients is education that chiropractic help may be available and offering this one-time free service. Given that, then we would go into the Central Hudson test, which is what the district court erred in not doing. And in that, the burden now rests with the state to demonstrate some substantial interest that the state has for regulating speech in this manner, especially in the manner of a broad prohibition. Nothing really was done on that other than to recite Desnick.
How many chiropractors are there in Illinois?
I'm sorry, how many,
chiropractors are there?
You know, Your Honor, I really don't know, but in Springfield alone, which is where he wants to practice, there certainly are several dozen, maybe 40. There certainly could be thousands of them throughout the state, I would expect.
So if this rule, if we had to get to the merits of this thing, and this rule is unconstitutional, every chiropractor could engage in telemarketing to soft tissue accident victims in the state, and people would get
they would have
potentially 1,000 telephone calls from telemarketers advertising the services of a chiropractor.
Well, certainly it's very unlikely that a chiropractor in Carbondale is going to be calling a victim in Springfield or Chicago, so I don't know how many thousands, but they certainly are free to try to communicate with people. What the state has a right to do is try to regulate it in a meaningful and narrowly drawn way that addresses the concerns that they've got.
But aren't the state interests here really compelling because it's a regulation of medical professionals? They want to try to prevent overreaching. They want to protect residential and personal privacy in addition to protecting potentially vulnerable citizens. And the statute has been upheld.
Well, what we learned from the Supreme Court's decision in Edenfield is the state can't just walk into court and say we're worried that consumers will be misled or their privacy rights interfered with. They have to actually produce some kind of evidence, some kind of history, and no attempt was made to do that. In fact, they just relied on the mere statements themselves. As to that, there is no undue influence in what speech Dr. Goodman proposes to use. And to answer a question, you know, this is a case challenging this statute as applied to Dr. Goodman and these facts. This is not a facial challenge that we're asking the court to rule on. And you're not going to rule today on the constitutionality.
But how can you make that decision without a transcript of what the, or a script of what the telemarketers are going to say?
I do invite the court to look again at the transcript of the testimony. It really did go in detail to each of the elements of what this brief telephone call was going to consist of.
So if the court had ruled in your favor, then would your client be limited to what you had presented? Because you're saying the whole reason you didn't do the script was because you didn't want your client limited to the script. So would they have been limited to what was said in the transcript?
During the course of the preliminary injunction until trial, yes.
That's the observations of the doctor, right?
I'm sorry?
Those are the observations of the doctor as to what the limitations of the communication would be.
Well, and the doctor is going to have these as his full-time employees in his office where he's supervising them. He's the one that's going to be telling them what they can and can't say.
We don't have the literal or figurative voice of these messages, do we?
No.
Is a typical telemarketer gets paid by the success of the referrals. Isn't that how that usually works?
I don't know how that usually works. It may in some, not in this case.
We couldn't assume that that's how it would work?
No, he testified to the contrary. These are
salaried telemarketers?
They're salaried employees who are only going to be making 10 telephone calls apiece for the two employees. Otherwise, they've got clerical tasks in the office to perform and other functions. So they're going to be making a limited number of phone calls to a targeted audience. They've got very strict guidelines there to follow. And no, they're not compensated in any way as to whether or not the person makes an appointment, doesn't make an appointment, or does or doesn't use the doctor for treatment. I'm pretty well into my rebuttal time, and I really would like to reserve a little if it's okay with the court.
Surely.
I appreciate that, and I'll return to answer questions in a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Draper. Ms. Welch.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm here on behalf of the department, and it's the other defendants here. Plaintiff didn't mention at the outset that he has three strikes against him. One is the highly deferential standard of review here, the abuse of discretion. The second is that preliminary injunctions are a drastic and extraordinary remedy. They're rare, and they should not be given without a very clear showing that the plaintiff is entitled to the preliminary injunction. As the court has indicated and the district court found, that preliminary showing just wasn't made. And the third strike that the plaintiff has against him is the presumption of constitutionality. That is, that the statutes are presumed to be constitutional. So, now we look at what happened in the district court. Plaintiff wanted a preliminary injunction. And so he presented only, as the court has pointed out, only his own description of what he anticipated that his employees would say to these people who have been injured quite recently. I mean, this is his target audience, who have been injured, maybe under medication, maybe taking, likely are taking painkillers and so on. These people are particularly vulnerable. And as the court pointed out, these are the very kinds of people that the state has a substantial interest in protecting. Now,
let me just ask you here, though I understand this is seems sort of a, like sleazy stuff to me, but you send some investigator down to go through recent accident reports and find people with soft tissue injuries. Somebody has to generate that list of people. Would it violate Illinois law for the chiropractor to send a letter to those people?
Absolutely not. And this is what we were suggesting in our brief. The problem here is what plaintiff's objecting to is that he can't use the precise, most effective manner of contacting these recent victims of accidents. Now, he could put exactly, presuming that he's complying with the substance of the statute and in terms of what the content of his message is supposed to be, he can put exactly the same information in a letter. You know, hi, you know,
this
here
am I.
This
is the kind of thing that lawyers do when you...
I'm sorry?
Lawyers do that.
I'm sure they do, and they're allowed to. You know, I mean, this is, again, what this case is identical for our purposes to the Florida Bar versus the Wenferit case, because in that case what happened was that the Supreme Court held that that the state may prohibit, and in fact the bar, let me go back, the bar, the solicitation ban in Florida was broader than it is here, because what it said is you can't talk to them for the first 30 days. You can't have any communication with them in the first 30 days. What we're saying is the 30 days is okay with us, but you can't talk to them directly because, as the FTC has said, as Desnick said, as the Supreme Court has said, personal solicitation, even by phone, is inherently coercive. I mean, it just has, and presumably that's why telemarketers telemarket, because telemarketing, personal contact, even over the phone, is more effective, that is to say coercive, than a letter.
Could the good doctor, through his employees, hand deliver those letters, knock on the door, and to the same target audience as well?
That would be a closer case. In my opinion, yes. Yes, I think it would be solicitation, and it would violate the statute.
Because
it would be in person. So I think that the in-personness, and this is what the Supreme Court decided in O'Rourke and, you know, Wenferit and so on, it's the in-personness, either by phone or face-to-face, that is the coercive element.
Because there's a potential for further conversation? I mean, if the employee says, here's a letter from Dr. Goodman, who's a chiropractor, and that says no more, but would there be the fear that it would be engaging, there could be other conversations that would be similar to the phone? Is that
right, precisely. And let me point out one thing from the plaintiff's testimony. He says, the second thing, this is on page 5 of his reply brief, the second thing is the purpose of the call. He's describing, again, the contents of the call. And that's to talk to them about health problems that they possibly could be having due to an automobile accident they were recently in. Well, who knows what that conversation could be about? Who knows how coercive that is? You're talking tone of voice, you're talking, you know, in person, you're talking body language, and all of these come together to have this extremely coercive effect on a very vulnerable person, because it's targeted to people who are in accidents, who have just been in accidents, and again, who might very likely be on medication. Now, the district court, given how very little evidence, hard evidence, that the plaintiff put forth at the preliminary injunction stage, the district court simply wasn't able to come to any conclusion about whether the speech was protected. And the court's analysis stopped there. Now plaintiff wants to keep going to review not only the whole Central Hudson test, but also, even though no findings were made, no factual findings, no legal conclusions, so there's nothing for this court to review with regard to Central Hudson, but also for the whole preliminary injunction action. And again, there was no finding about any of the factors, and certainly most important, no finding on the balance of harms. And this is where the district court's role is really crucial, because that's where it uses its discretion to figure out what the proper balance of harm is. And that's why, again, abuse of discretion is such a highly deferential standard. And this court couldn't exercise it because there hasn't been any finding on any of those aspects of this case.
If the appellant is simply challenging the general ban on solicitation, did the district court need to know the particulars of the script?
Well, plaintiff is suggesting that this was an as-applied mm-hmm. challenge. So in that regard, yes, the district court did have to know what the contents were. Yes. If this court does find that the speech, that the district court was incorrect in finding that the speech was not protected, plaintiff asked to have the case sent back to the district court to have a preliminary injunction entered. But as I was saying, the district court hasn't gone through the analysis. So if this court does find that the speech was protected, the plaintiff had met his burden of making a preliminary showing of protected speech, which he had to do because this was a preliminary injunction motion. It's not summary judgment, and therefore the state didn't really have the burden. Again, the plaintiff had the burden. Then what should happen is the case should be remanded back to the district court, not for the entry of a preliminary injunction, but for a continuation of the district court's findings. And then that decision in its totality could be reviewed. If the court doesn't have any questions, thank you. We ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Draper.
Thank you. If I may, I want to turn immediately to the scope of the regulatory scheme here. We quoted in the complaint, and this says at page 4 of the complaint, the Act and the rules. And the section 26 of the Act says, a person licensed under this Act may advertise the availability of professional services in the public media or on the premises where his business is conducted. That's it. Letters aren't allowed of the kind that Dr. Goodman would like to use to get his message to victims in automobile accidents. And in-person communications of other kinds are flatly banned, and Dr. Goodman risks having his license revoked if he engages any of this prohibited activity.
Does the regulations or the regulatory scheme allow for advisory opinions? Could Dr. Goodman seek?
No, they have nothing by which they can review. And these are the kinds of things that the state can and should consider in amending the statute and in drafting appropriate rules. But it is the burden of the state to first come forward with some evidence. In the First Amendment context, the burden's on the state to show that it has a substantial interest. And as Edenfield taught us, that has to be done with something more than just saying it out loud. This is not like the shifting burdens in the McDonnell-Douglas test. The state has to produce something. And in the one case where there was this limitation in Shapiro, there had been a very lengthy, 200-page study submitted by the Bar Association about the consumer responses to attorney contact. The state hasn't met that burden, and the district court abused its discretion.
Thank you, Mr. Draper. Ms. Welch, the case is taken under advisement.